This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, "My Lord, show me how you revive the dead," he said, "Do you not believe?" He said, "Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest." He said, "Take four of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise." Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by a front, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Midstream.
The 14th has arrived in Lebanon on an official pastoral visit, a journey framed by appeals for peace and interfaith dialogue, but shadowed by deep frustration in parts of the country that his schedule will not reach. I'm standing here to speak directly to that absence. Lebanon's south was among the areas most devastated during the 2024 war. Entire towns saw homes, schools, and places of worship reduced to rubble, and Christian communities there suffered alongside their Muslim neighbors. Independent assessments and UN reporting documented widespread damage to civilian infrastructure and religious sites across southern municipalities, yet the papal itinerary amidst those southern towns. For many families in villages from Tyre to the border, that omission feels like a missed moment of pastoral solidarity. Khan al-Jalil, part of the broader Tyre region and a site venerated in local Christian tradition because of its links to gospel narratives, is emblematic. A place where memory, identity, and history meet and where several Christian landmarks were harmed in the fighting. The absence of Qana from the schedule is experienced not as a minor logistical detail, but as the absence of recognition for communities that endured bombing, displacement, and loss. There are concrete reasons that can shape a papal route: security considerations in a fragile ceasefire, diplomatic calculations, and the logistics of protecting the pontiff in a still volatile environment. Those are real constraints and they matter. But pastoral leadership also carries a symbolic weight. When a faith leader passes through a nation marked by recent trauma, his presence in the hardest hit places can be a profound source of consolation and public witness. Many Lebanese Christians in the South feel the balance here has tilted away from that witness. Finally, on Gaza, Pope Leo XIV has urged investigation and called for respect for human dignity, but has been cautious about using the legal label genocide as an outright declaration. That stance aimed, the Vatican says, at a careful legal assessment, has frustrated Palestinians and many Christians who live under siege or who have lost family. For Gazan Christians too, the suffering is real and immediate. Their pain is part of the human story the Pope came to Lebanon to acknowledge. This visit can still matter deeply. What those in the south and Gaza seek now is not polemics, but recognition. That their losses are seen, their churches and homes remembered, and their calls for justice met with concrete compassion. A papal presence in those places would have been a powerful sign that no community is left outside the circle of care. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. As Pope Leo XIV begins his historic visit to Lebanon, his message of unity and compassion is overshadowed by growing discontent among communities who feel unseen. Today we examine why the omission of South Lebanon and the Vatican's reluctance to label the massacre in Gaza a genocide is raising painful questions for Eastern Christians living under constant threat. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Miriam Sharabati, political commentator and writer. It's a pleasure having you with us, Miriam. And I know you can be with us because of the actual papal visit in Lebanon. The roads are mainly closed in most of the Lebanese territories where the Pope will be visiting. But as a Lebanese Christian yourself, how do you interpret the Pope's decision to exclude the south of Lebanon, a region where churches were bombed, families were displaced, and Christian heritage sites like, for example, Khan al-Jalil, where Jesus Christ performed his first miracle, they were devastated by the war. What kind of message does this send to communities who expected pastoral solidarity rather than just diplomatic caution?
Right. First of all, thank you for having me. When we look at what the decision of the Pope visiting Lebanon, excluding the South, first of all, we must understand that no Pope in the history of the visits has ever visited southern Lebanon. And this time, particularly, until now, so we've seen the Pope meet all the Lebanese officials in the presidential palace. We have not heard a single word regarding Israeli aggressions. We didn't hear it from the Pope. We didn't particularly hear it from the Lebanese president either. So when we look at that, it feels like once again, Eastern Christians, especially Arab Christians, outside of the realm of Kirke, right? So the Christian Maronites of Lebanon, are being slightly abandoned. We're not talking about the Christians of Akkar, so northern Lebanon, where they face a lot of issues, and they currently face a real existential threat from the Syria side. We're not talking about the Christians in the Bekaa, where they're getting bombed as well. We're not talking about the Christians of the south who have been living under existential threat and who are the people where Jesus Christ has actually walked and passed, and where the disciples have been, right? It holds a high Christian value, but we haven't seen any real position to tell those people that they should stay in their land, to tell those people that, well, you martyred inside your churches, and we understand the meaning of that, and we stand by you, right? We did not see any of that, and in my opinion, I don't think that's a slip on Vatican's end, because we didn't even see it from the Lebanese Christian leadership to a large degree. I don't want to put all of them together because we did see a good number of clergy visit, but they're not mostly Catholics, right? So that brings us back to the topic of Vatican. Is Vatican here to realign the positioning of the church to fit the needs of the people, or is Vatican putting again a policy that fits a larger vision of a changed Middle East? And I think this is a question we are asking, and no one is sure yet. We're waiting to see where the visit goes.
And that policy that you mentioned, Miriam, We've seen with the Pope repeatedly avoiding using the word genocide when referring to what happened in Gaza, even though we have a Gaza's Christian community that has suffered alongside its Muslim population due to this genocide. How does this linguistic hesitation really affect the morale and trust of Eastern Christians who feel abandoned by Western church leadership?
That position of neutrality of Vatican, which it had adopted, or alleged neutrality, if I'm going to call it, because he did meet with Bartholomew in Turkey, and Bartholomew is a controversial person within the Orthodox Church, who had stood with Ukraine in the face of Russia. In the Nazi era, Vatican had no issues in having connections with Nazi Germany, right? In Latin America, when the U.S. coups were happening, Vatican stood with the elites in the face of liberation theology and otherwise the people. Right? We've seen a repeated position on this. In Lebanon specifically, the visits of the last popes, so the ones in the 90s, they all came at very critical moments. Mm-hmm. While the visit of St. John Paul II stood significantly different, it still felt like a sense of abandoning to a certain degree. But his visit to Damascus and his speech from Damascus particularly angered the Israelis. He was very clear in his position. Even within the scope of the neutral language. So what I'm trying to say is that that neutral language, you can't have a position without explicitly stating that you stand opposed to Israel. But to explicitly state that there isn't a genocide in Gaza, I think you're making a statement. You're not standing neutral, especially that on his trip from Turkey to Beirut, on the plane, he was asked about the Palestine-Israeli conflict, right? Because mm-hmm. that's the framing they would offer. And his answer was, there is one solution, which is Palestinian statehood, and until today, the Israelis have rejected that solution. All right, now we know this. What's the position of Vatican? Are we waiting until Israelis accept it for another 70, 80 years? Or
maybe wipes out the entire population? But
exactly, another 100,000.
With wrapping up this visit, Miriam, if you want to wrap up this visit, which is still ongoing in Lebanon, in your view, what long-term impact does this visit with its omissions and restrained language leave on the relationship between the Vatican and the Eastern Christians living under the reality of Israeli entity aggression? Do you really believe this will widen the gap between lived Christian experience in the East and the political positioning of global Christian institutions, which for some reason is siding with Israel?
I think to a large degree it will have a divided response, because for the Christians in Lebanon that are making pro-Zionist statements, Vatican will come and say, listen, you cannot do that. You cannot hate the Muslims in your community, basically, because Vatican has no interest in that. At the end of the day, they do work from an interest-based perspective. And when it comes to the Christians that are anti-Israel and are pro-resistance, it will come to them and say, well, listen, if you're going to keep doing that, we have nothing to do with you, right? And it puts everyone in that position of, how do we understand peace? Is it subjugation that we're talking about? A subjugation to a certain version of neutrality that puts all of our lives in danger because we're facing an existential threat in the face of an entity that literally wants us all dead? And I think that's the question that's not being addressed. That's the question that's not being approached at all. And when it is, it's being approached in a very naive way, like saying, oh, we do not accept anyone to use God's name to launch a war. Well, we're not launching a war in God's name. Mm-hmm. We are actually launching a defense in God's name. We are standing for the oppressed in God's name. We are facing killers in God's name.
an existential threat, literally an existential threat of everyone, especially the Christian communities in the areas that Zionist Israel is attempting to decimate. But unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. I want to thank you very much, Miriam Sharabati, political commentator and writer, for joining us to talk about this, because it means a lot for the Christians of the East, where the Christians where their areas witnessed the birth and the life of Jesus Christ himself, to be literally left alone in the face of the Israeli aggression. Thank you very much for your time and your contribution. Ladies and gents, stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about Beijing's defiance in Syria.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
In Beijing, a village in southern Syria, civilians took a stand against an Israeli entity incursion, confronting occupation forces directly, even as airstrikes claimed the lives of entire families. Today, we explore what this extraordinary act of grassroots resistance reveals about the readiness of the Syrian people to defend their land and the political vacuum left by the Julani regime's distancing from confronting Zionist Israel. More details in the following report.
Beijing has become yet another Syrian village forced to endure the fire of Zionist occupation. According to local witness accounts, early Friday dawned under the roar of tanks, helicopters, and fighter jets. An incursion by Israeli occupation forces into Beijing triggered a chain of events that ended with more than a dozen Syrians, including children, killed, dozens wounded, and entire families devastated. A patrol of Israeli occupation forces is said to have entered the town attempting arrests. Syrian sources reported that during the incursion, residents surrounded the patrol, resisting the attempt. In the ensuing exchange of fire, six soldiers were reportedly wounded. But the story did not end there. As the Israeli entity forces withdrew, they used artillery, drones, and air power to strike Beijing. That shelling and bombardment, indiscriminate, left at least 13 Syrians dead, including women and children, and dozens more wounded, some critically. Homes were destroyed, entire families wiped out, and a displaced community scattered. The government in Damascus swiftly condemned the raid as a war crime, a premeditated assault on civilians under the guise of a security operation. This is not merely a failed arrest operation gone wrong. For many observers, Beijing marks a turning point. Syrian civilians began resisting the occupation alone, without support from Damascus, signaling a new phase of grassroots armed defiance. If so, what does this mean for the future of the occupation and for the Syrian people's determination to defend their land? First, Beijing shows that occupation will never be accepted, not even under limited raids. Civilians fired back the moment soldiers crossed into their land. When the occupier traded dialogue for bombs, the price was devastating. This is clear evidence of a rising, popular, and decentralized Syrian resistance. Second, the brutal bombardment that followed local resistance exposes the occupier's weakness. When its ground forces falter, it turns to airstrikes and collective punishment. This pattern strips away any claim of self-defense. Third, Damascus condemned the attack but provided no real protection. For many in Beijing, this feels like abandonment, left to face raids, shelling, and insecurity alone. Beijing is more than a village. It's a warning to the occupier that even civilians will resist, to nearby regimes that silence will not be forgotten, and to the world that violence against civilians only strengthens the will to resist, not break it. For Syrians, Beijing will long be etched into memory, a martyrdom, a tragedy, but also a declaration. Land, dignity, and resistance belong together.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hassan Hijazi, political commentator, expert in Zionist affairs. It's a pleasure having you with us, Mr. Hijazi. Now, how does the popular resistance in Beit Jinn in Syria, where civilians confronted Israeli occupation forces and really paid a heavy price, redefine the balance of power on the ground in southern Syria? What does this really tell us about the limits of Zionist Israel's incursions in Syria?
There is no doubt that this confrontation reflects a turning point in the Syrian landscape within the areas occupied and repeatedly violated by the Israeli entity. Since the fall of the former Syrian regime, there had been no real state of popular resistance, largely due to the dire circumstances faced by the Syrian people emerging from a long and devastating internal war. But it now appears that this phase is witnessing the formation of local groups willing to fight, no longer prepared to accept a situation in which occupation forces carry out daily incursions and dozens of assaults on Syrian villages in the buffer zone and the areas north of it. The occupation has effectively transformed southern Syria into an open zone of operations where it acts freely, as though there were no people, no state, and no trace of Syrian sovereignty. This reality has deeply provoked Syrians. The escalation in targeted attacks, raids, arrests, and humiliations inflicted on Syrians in those areas has generated a strong popular backlash, expressed repeatedly through protests and other forms of civil resistance. But today's scene goes further. It confirms a state of mounting anger and intense resentment toward the occupation, with tensions reaching a point where Syrian civilians themselves have taken up arms to confront the Zionist soldiers. This development underscores how the occupation continues to escalate day after day through assassinations, raids, and violations, attempting by various means to impose security dominance and assert a supposed right to infiltrate and operate within these regions, under the pretext of arrangements previously discussed with the Syrian side. This behavior reflects the extent of Zionist arrogance and overreach, showing complete disregard for the sovereignty of neighboring states, international law, and the basic rights of people living in these areas. The occupation acts as though it is entitled to violate these lands and terrorize their inhabitants. But it seems this era is reaching its end. Syrians are no longer willing to remain silent. They will confront this Israeli entity escalation with force and resolve.
Despite that, Mr. Hassan, the Julani regime in Damascus appears eager to pursue some sort of a rapprochement with Zionist Israel through the so-called Abraham Accords, rather than actually support the local resistance in southern Syria. How does this political stance affect the morale and the strategic capabilities of Syrian civilians defending their own land because they are left alone?
In truth, any form of resistance requires two essential factors. The first relates to popular support, and this seems to be emerging in the reality of southern Syria. The recent clash and the widespread denunciation it sparked clearly reflect this growing base of support. However, the official position of the Syrian government, including the government of Ahmed al-Sharr, continues to lean toward negotiation. Since the first day it assumed authority in Damascus, the Sharr administration declared that it had only one option: settlement, peace, and the accompanying slogans. This reality suggests that Syrian parties seeking to confront the occupation must have political backing inside Damascus, a supportive political front that empowers resistance to become a legitimate option for the Syrian people, both at the popular and official levels. Persisting in the path of settlements, contemplating joining the Abraham Accords, and seeking security arrangements with the occupation have all proven to be ineffective approaches that will neither restore Syrian rights nor expel the occupier. The situation mirrors that of the Palestinians. The occupier openly declares it will not withdraw from the areas it recently seized, particularly the summit of Mount Hermon on the Syrian side. Add to this its insistence on retaining full freedom of movement, and its demand that the United States guarantee, in any future agreement, the right to strike any target it wishes inside Syria. Without a firm and unwavering official stance capable of confronting these demands, the occupation will attempt to cement these violations into permanent facts on the ground, granting itself the supposed right to continue this level of aggression on Syrian territory.
Well, Mr. Hijazi, looking forward to what has happened, what lessons can be drawn from Beijing for the broader Syrian struggle against the Zionist occupation, which, as you said, wants to remain in Mount Hermon? Does this even signal some sort of a new decentralized form of resistance capable of challenging occupation without even relying on state support?
لا شك أن حالة المقاومة تتماهى عن الموقف الرسمي عموما يعني في تجربة المقاومة.
There is no doubt that resistance movements often diverge from official state positions. In the early experiences of popular resistance, whether in Syria, Palestine or Lebanon, these formations arose from the will of the people, independent of official institutions. When states themselves enter into direct confrontation, it can actually limit the effectiveness of the resistance, because the occupation can pressure governments by targeting their assets, infrastructure, and institutions. Relying on popular momentum grants the resistance far greater freedom of movement and protects it from being tied to political agendas or constraints imposed on the government in Damascus. A resistance movement built on popular forces, on capabilities that do not necessarily stem from official structures, can continue and grow, especially if there is genuine will among the Syrian people, among numerous organizations, parties, and military or political groups capable of taking on such a role without requiring full and formal endorsement from the authorities. Yet even in such a scenario, the state cannot oppose such resistance, for it is exercising a legitimate right, the right to self-defense, the right to defend sovereignty, and the right to confront an occupation that violates borders for no reason whatsoever. There is no justification for the occupation's presence in southern Syria. There is no justification for its arrests, assassinations, and repeated violations, except for the lies propagated by Israeli entity propaganda. We are, in fact, witnessing a landscape that suggests new horizons, a profound sense of hope that a significant awakening is emerging in southern Syria, where groups are forming to confront the occupation. I believe this path will yield positive results for Syrians. It will force the occupation to reassess its calculations carefully and may eventually push it to retreat from the areas it has seized and to put an end to its daily aggressions.
But the interesting part, Mr. Hassan, is that we heard the Syrian official Syrian regime's statements saying that they would urge the so-called international community to make Israel stop its aggression. This is the same thing that we hear here in Lebanon. It's the same statements that are being said by officials, but the people are not being helped. They are being left alone. So do they have the capabilities to fight against Zionist Israel?
In truth, putting aside the official position, which has come to rely on options that have proven ineffective, the popular reality is different. Yes, Syrians suffer from many crises. They face severe economic, social, and military challenges, especially after the Israeli entity destroyed much of the Syrian army's capabilities. But a popular resistance movement does not require extensive resources. A small amount of equipment, paired with the will to resist, is enough to build a formidable resistance experience, one capable of posing a significant challenge to the occupation. Ultimately, the matter hinges on popular will, on the readiness to confront and sacrifice in order to achieve the desired outcomes.
I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hassan Hijazi, political commentator, expert in Zionist affairs, for joining us to talk about the pressing matter of southern Syria against the Zionist Israeli entity's incursions. Ladies and gents, thank you. Please do follow us to get more updates about the region of West Asia right here on the Mideast Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them. Allahu Allah, Allahu Allah.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi and we are with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the contents of chapter Ankabut. Dear brothers and sisters, we have reached the 40th verse of Surah Ankabut.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
فكلاً أخذنا بذنبه فمنهم من أرسلنا عليه حاصبا ومنهم من أخذته الصيحة ومنهم من خسفنا به الأرض ومنهم من أغرقنا وما كان الله ليظلمهم ولكن كانوا أنفسهم يظلمون
So each we seized for his sin, and among them were those upon whom we sent a storm of stones, and among them were those who were seized by the blast from the sky, and among them were those whom we caused the earth to swallow, and among them were those whom we drowned. And Allah would not have wronged them, but it was they who were wronging themselves.
So, as you listen to the verse, in this holy verse, the Almighty Allah starts saying, فَكُلًّا أَخَذْنَا بِذَنْبِهِ So each of them we seized in punishment for his sin. So as you were with us in the previous episodes, and in the 39th verse specifically, we discussed the ending state of وَقَارُونَ وَفِرْعَوْنَ وَهَامَانَ That's what the verse said. The ending of Qarun, Pharaoh, and Haman was that the Almighty Allah destroyed them all. So this verse continues, فَكُلًّا أَخَذْنَا بِذَنْبِهِ And each of them we seized in punishment for his sin. فَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ أَرْسَلْنَا عَلَيْهِ حَاصِبًا And one of them, against some, we sent a violent tornado. وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ أَخَذَتْهُ الصَّيْحَةُ Some were caught by a mighty blast. وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ خَسَفْنَا بِهِ الْأَرْضِ And some, we caused the earth to swallow up. وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ أَغْرَقْنَا And some, we drowned. وَمَا كَانَ اللَّهُ لِيَظْلِمَهُمْ It was not Allah to do injustice to them. وَلَكِنْ كَانُوا أَنفُسَهُمْ يَظْلِمُونَ That's the point. They were doing injustice unto themselves. So, the point is, we must not become proud when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives us respite. Since the end of sin is retribution, and it is easy for Allah to punish us with kinds of punishment. Because the previous verse said, وَمَا كَانُوا صَابِقِينَ They could not overreach us. They could not escape from the grips of the Almighty Allah. So in this verse, He subhanahu wa ta'ala says, فَكُلًّا أَخَذْنَا بِذَنْبِهِ Indeed, since there were mentioned four groups in the previous two verses whose punishments were not mentioned there, the people of Ad, the people of Thamud, Qarun, Pharaoh and Haman, in this verse, their chastisement are stated sequentially. So it says, And of them, against some we sent a violent tornado. فَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ أَرْسَلْنَا عَلَيْهِ حَاصِبًا The Quranic word hasib means a violent wind, bringing with it a shower of stones. That's the meaning of it. So, hasban means some pebbles in Arabic. But the objective of meaning, the objective of actually mentioning this group is the people of Ad. That according to different chapters of the Quran, like Dhariyat, like other chapters like Qamar, a violent or harsh wind came over them for 7 nights and 8 days, and it ruined their houses and threw their corpse here and there like the leaves of the trees in fall. So that's the ending of only one group. What will happen to the next? So, anyway, after this verse mentioned the ending of the people of Ad, فَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ أَرْسَلْنَا عَلَيْهِ حَاصِبًا, we move on to the next group. The verse continues saying, وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ أَخَذَتْهُ الصَّيْحَةً, and some were caught up by a mighty blast. We have said that the heavenly blast is the result of thunderbolts, which are usually accompanied with earthquake at the center of its occurrence. And this was the chastisement which came down upon the people of Thamud. Yes, the people of Thamud and other people like people of Thamud. That's their ending. And this was the punishment with the Qarun. What was it? وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ خَسَفْنَا بِهِ الْأَرْضِ. This is the third chastisement. We caused the earth to swallow up him, actually. To swallow up Qarun is his punishment. That was his punishment. The rich, proud, arrogant Qarun from the children of Israel. Finally, Allah drowns some others. وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ أَغْرَقْنَا. And some of them we drowned. We know that this meaning is pointing to Pharaoh, Haman, and their followers, which has been mentioned in different chapters of the Quran, and that's how we know it, actually. However, keeping this statement in mind, the above four chastisements are sequentially for the four evil groups whose deviation and sins were mentioned in the previous verses. But for an emphasis upon this fact, that they got the result of their own deeds and actually reaped the product of the seeds of which they themselves had scattered, the end of the verse with actually explicit attention says, وَلَكِنْ وَمَا كَانَ اللَّهُ لِيَظْلِمَهُمْ. Don't you think that Allah does injustice to them? وَلَكِنْ كَانُوا أَنفُسَهُمْ يَظْلِمُونَ. They unto their own selves were doing injustice. So the punishments in this world and the next world are some reactions. These punishments in the next world are the embodiments of man's deeds. And actually, that's how the Almighty Allah mentions it. So the belief of the followers of the school of fatalism, who also exist amongst the Muslims, is made futile by this strong logic of the Quran. Why? Because this verse clearly strengthens the principle of freedom of will in mankind and makes this fact fully clear that making decision everywhere and for everything belongs to man himself alone and no one else. And Allah has created him free and Allah has wanted him to be free, actually. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode as well. We took great help from the enlightening commentary into the light of the Holy Quran, available in the website al-islam.org. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Balochistan is populated by over 9,000 villages. The village of Ghalanor dates back to the Qajar period, and since this area isn't prone to earthquakes, the adobe houses have managed to survive for about 150 years. Isn't that amazing?
About 40 kilometers from the city of Zobol, this village was originally built on top of a hill and witnessed the migration of the villages of Old Fort. In fact, that's where it gets its name, Ghalanor, which means new fort. Ghalanor was built on high ground to protect its occupants from flood, since the varying amount of the flowing water of the Hamul River has always caused different problems for the people living in the Sistan Basin. But that's not the only thing the architects of this village had up their sleeves. During the Qajar period in the 18th and 19th centuries, different regions were managed by overlords or khans. The most eye-catching structure here is the two-story adobe castle of the Khan of the region. It was built at the entrance of the village and around a small hill, so the top of the hill is the floor of the second story. The village is currently being restored and is going to be turned into an eco-tourism village. Kilometers from Ghalanor lies a mysterious and ancient city referred to over the past 200 to 300 years as Dahani Ghulaman, or Gateway of the Slaves. Dahani Ghulaman is the largest Achaemenian site in the entire eastern section of Iran that has been dated back to between the 4th and the 6th century BC. More importantly, it's the only Achaemenid site that may hold within its depths the secrets of the lifestyle of the ordinary people living at that time. Built in the wilderness, away from the imperial capital, even with the alignment of buildings roughly in a straight line, running southwest to northeast along the edge of water supplies, the site was only inhabited for a brief period of a century or a century and a half, and was abandoned as a result of natural forces that have always determined the survival and migration of urban settlements in the arid region of Sistan. The entire site was covered by sand. After it was dug up about 50 years ago in the 1960s, the layout of this ancient city was studied extensively by archaeologists from around the world. And it seems that they all came to a similar conclusion. The precise architecture and great harmony in the design of Dahani Ghulaman suggests that it was built with urban planning in mind about 2,500 years ago. Geometric studies on this site have revealed 27 major structures and an additional 23 buildings, most of which have not yet been unearthed. It was believed that the Achaemenids used architectural plans only in the construction of palaces and important buildings, such as the royal residences of Pasargadae, Persepolis, Susa, as well as Dasht-e Gohar. But it seems that the people of Dahani, Ghulaman, even prepared an architectural plan for the construction of their alleys and ordinary houses. The urban planning, the architecture, the temple, the location and size of what remains of this ancient city have led scholars to believe that it was a satrapal capital or something very similar to it in character. Studies into the origins of the hearths, fireplaces and altars have tried to reveal their purpose since they have a unique architecture. Were they used for animal sacrifices since animal blood was found on the altars? What kind of rituals were performed here? All these studies have tried to find answers to the many questions that arose 40 years ago with the unearthing of the site and have never been completely answered, even to this day. Standing atop the nearby hill that gives you an overview of the site, you can see lakes filled with a considerable amount of water around it.
The Chaimima reservoirs in the south of Zabul are three big lakes that are the second most important water storage reservoirs in the region. The water stored in these big lakes is used to irrigate the Sistan Plain and to provide drinking water for the cities of Zabul and Zahedan.
Trees were planted all around the lakes by the University of Zabul to prevent dust from falling into the water. This is Golnar Farnoudi for Iran.
Behind this beautiful old wooden door lies an ancient civilization, a wealth of cultural, artistic, and religious jewels that portray the civilization of a nation.
The Qom Astana Museum, located in the city of Qom, right near the holy shrine of Fatima Masuma, sister of Imam Riza, opened up its doors to the public back in 1935. The museum has an area of 1,000 square meters with two floors hosting two exhibition halls. More than 1,000 artifacts and objects of artistic, cultural and historical value are displayed here. These treasures belong to different periods in history, from the 1st and 2nd millennium BC to the Islamic era in the country. The museum displays a wide range of objects and artifacts, varying from paintings, chinaware, ceramics and pottery to priceless handmade rugs, glassware and precious Qurans.
Museum near to the shrine of Fatima Masura. It's wonderful to look around this museum, particularly to look at the carpet, beautiful carpet, and with the silk, beautifully designed. And also, I look around some other places to look at the Quran, the oldest Quran from the 9th century to the present time. It's amazing to keep those kind of like traditional symbolic teachings of Prophet Muhammad.
The crown jewel of Iran's handicraft industry is its beautiful handmade rugs and carpets. Excavations in Iran have revealed that this art dates back to the 1st and 2nd millennium BC. The treasured silk rugs in this museum are valuable for their extraordinary designs, rich combination of colors, and excellent texture. One of the main features of Islamic architecture is the gorgeous glazed tiles that decorate the interior and exterior of the buildings. This art form reached new heights during the 14th century when the Timurid Empire ruled the country. The oldest tiles in this museum belong to the Seljuk era, some 12 centuries ago. Beautiful doors opened up to. There must have been a beautiful heaven behind these doors that inspired the artist to create wonders on these beautiful creations. The decorated doors displayed here date back to different time periods, but all adorned beautifully with different artistic techniques. Some are decorated with the art of marquetry, wood inlaying and wood carving with delicate pieces of ivory, bone, brass, gold and silver sections. Others are made with metal, embellished with inscriptions written by the best calligraphers of the time. Size isn't really an issue when it comes to narrating history. Some items here in this museum are quite small in size, but great and precise narrators that reveal historical facts. Museums are the spiritual and cultural treasures of a nation that clearly display the wisdom, intelligence, and artistic abilities of the past generations. These jewels are ever eternal. Hoda Lezgi for Iran.